Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For half a century and more now, George Shultz has been in the thick of where history is made. As a young Marine in the Pacific in World War II, as an economic advisor to Dwight D. Eisenhower, as Richard Nixon's Secretary of Labor and Treasury, and most famously as Ronald Reagan's sure-handed Secretary of State, George Shultz still appears to have the ear of nearly every major Republican politician, and he's still thinking hard about our country and the challenges it faces. This hour on Point, former Secretary of State George Shultz on the State of the Nation. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is George Shultz. He was made Secretary of State by Ronald Reagan in 1982 and served until the end of Reagan's second term in 1989. Shultz earned a Ph.D. in economics at MIT in 1949. He's been a powerful conservative thinker and doer for decades. In 1998, he introduced Condoleezza Rice to then-Texas Governor George W. Bush. He's been called the father of the Bush Doctrine of Preemptive War on Terror. He's now a distinguished fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, a conservative think tank. His latest book focuses on what he describes as a coming crisis in American entitlement spending. It's called Putting Our House in Order, a Guide to Social Security and Healthcare Reform. George Shultz, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you. With all the enormous problems out there in the world and many on your screen, why are you focused on healthcare and Social Security at this point?
Because they represent very important problems and solutions. That is, income for the elderly is important to maintain, and we want to have a really good health care system. But the way they're now set up, the costs are threatening to escalate to the point where we won't be able to support them. So they're threatened as programs. And I and my colleague John Chauvin at Stanford and two young people who work with us, Matt Gunn and Gopi Shargota, have been working on this for a few years. And so we have a book that identifies the problem, all right, but we said we should write a book about solutions. So that's what our book tries to do.
You're a solid Republican. You've endorsed John McCain for the presidency, the Republican nomination. He's got a pretty different take on health care reform, just for starters, from the Democratic contenders here, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They push towards something more like universal health care. He doesn't. Are you supporting the McCain approach as opposed to universal health care, and why?
I don't think the coverage is the main point, because it seems to me for a long time we have in effect had a decision that we're going to favor spending on health care over most other forms of spending. That is, we subsidize it. And we should have that be fair and equitable. The question is, where should the subsidy go? And that's really where the issue is.
But when 47 or 48 million people don't have health care, we read, how can coverage not be the point?
Because if you were trying to list well-known conservative thinkers, you'd probably put Milton Friedman at the top of your list, right?
Sure. Yep.
And about 10 years ago, Milton wrote an article on how to reform health care. And what did he propose? He proposed giving each American a health care voucher, like a food stamp, a health stamp, that was risk-adjusted. That is, the more chances you had of needing access to the health care system, the higher your amount would be. And the purpose of the voucher would be to allow you to buy an insurance policy that covered a medical event that was very, very costly, and also provided you with a health savings account. When Milton wrote, the health savings account was not in existence, but some similar things were, and he had the concept. So that's universal coverage. Note the big point. It goes to the individual. So the idea was, I'm an individual. I have my chance to buy the kind of health care insurance that suits me.
Right.
And I have a health savings account, which isn't taxed. And I can spend it on sort of day-to-day health things that I need, or I husband it a little bit so that if I have to exercise my insurance policy, I've got something to go for the deductible. So in this way, consumers get into the act, and I think that's essential.
So when you look to a solution to the healthcare challenge, you look to healthcare accounts and individual responsibility. What about on the Social Security side? Are you lining up with George W. Bush's sort of ownership society vision of each individual responsible for their own retirement, on their own hook?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that, but that's not really where the action needs to be on Social Security in order to protect its solvency. That is, in about 8 or 9 years, according to most projections, the Social Security income, that is what comes in from the payroll taxes,
right,
will not be enough to pay the benefits that the system has agreed to pay out. So, and it'll get worse and worse. So that's the Social Security crisis. You've got to solve that problem. And as my colleagues and I studied it, it became very clear to us that you can easily identify the cause of the problem. You can see what are the alternative ways of solving it. And then if you want to add private accounts to that, which I think would be a good idea, why, I think you can do that. But the private accounts are neutral as far as solving the solvency problem is concerned. You've got to do that first.
You were there for the Reagan Revolution, right at the heart of it, both looking on the domestic side and particularly on the foreign policy side. I wonder how we've been talking recently with Stephen Greenhouse with the New York Times, who's got this new book out on the tough road that many working Americans have been on, seeing despite our economic growth and productivity gains and all the rest, their benefits, their job security, their wages in many circumstances, flat or in retreat. You know, here we are now, what, 20, 30 years after the Reagan Revolution. What do you make of what it's brought to the country in terms of income equity or inequity and job security, the general well-being of Americans?
Well, we've had 25 years of amazing stability in our economy. We've only had 5 down quarters in that whole period. And jobs have risen. Income per capita has risen. And inflation has been kept under control. All these are the legacy of the Reagan period. He led the way to a bipartisan tax reform act in 1986. Bill Bradley in the Senate, subsequent Democratic candidate for president, had the leading oar in the Senate on the Democratic side. Mm. And this 1986 tax act brought the marginal rate of taxation down to 28%. And that's the unsung hero of a lot of the prosperity that we've had, I think. It's now back up to 35%, down a little from where Bill Clinton left it, but still way above Ronald Reagan's 28%.
So many, many quarters of growth.
He gave us a very good period, and we have to learn the lesson that there are certain fundamental things you need to do, including keep monetary policy in such a shape that we don't have a return of inflation.
There's a lot of talk lately with what we've seen in the subprime crisis, with the Bear Stearns crisis, with the growing disparity of American incomes, that maybe the Reagan impulse has run its course or run beyond a kind of reasonable application, and the country needs to rein it in a little bit, look back toward a little more regulation, maybe even toward a bit higher taxation. What do you say to that, George Shultz?
Well, it seems to me that in the financial arena, that kind of got unraveled with the so-called subprime loan process, there needs to be more scrutiny of these financial instruments that get created to pass risk around to the point where nobody knows where it is. And that's been bad. But what? Here, look what happened. Mm. We had this housing boom, and the prices of houses escalated rapidly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people said, gee, where's the affordable housing? Prices are going up too much. So these financial wizards decided to figure out how to give houses away. How did they do it? They created these things called, now called subprime mortgages.
Right.
Where you have no down payment. You are given all sorts of especially easy terms. In effect, you're given a house. It's very unrealistic.
But is it, in effect, a natural outcome of deregulation and a kind of supermarket mentality?
Well, I don't think it necessarily is, but probably there should be some regulation of this area, a little more than has been so.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former Secretary of State George Shultz, celebrated conservative wise man, about the big challenges facing the United States today. His new book is Putting Our House in Order, A Guide to Social Security and Health Care Reform, co-authored with John Chauvin. George Shultz, you're 87, I think, now, if I've got that right, and still in the middle of things. I've got a David Brooks column from just a week or so ago, where he goes back to a speech that you gave at the Park Avenue Synagogue in New York 20 years ago or so, talking about, of all things, then fighting a war on terrorism, and how you said that means coping with uncertainty. And he says that then, all the way back then, you opened a rift within the Reagan administration with your view that uncertainty, and particularly around terrorism, should put the U.S. on an aggressive footing versus Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger then saying that uncertainty should make the country more cautious. Do you see that debate still going on today? And do you think your let's be aggressive, let's even be preemptive stance is worked out?
Well, it's very much going on today. Let me just quickly review the history of our interaction with the problem of terrorism. Mm. Remember the Munich Olympics. Israeli athletes were murdered. If you remember Sadat's assassination, why was he assassinated?
Anwar Sadat, Egypt, yep.
He made peace with Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Remember our Marine barracks being blown up. Embassies around the world. The U.S. coal attacked. What did we do about all that? Well, in the Reagan period, we taught Gaddafi a slight lesson, but very little was done. It was a period of being attacked. We saw that we were being attacked. I don't think we really understood its roots, but we didn't do anything much about it, other than say, we're going to enforce the law, we're going to find out who did this and try them and put them in jail. Now, I thought that was not an adequate response at the time, and I said so. Fortunately, President Reagan agreed with me. A lot of other people didn't. But I thought it's not enough to wait to be attacked. If you see an attack coming at you, what do? Wait for it to happen? No, you stop it from happening. So you need good intelligence, and you need a willingness to act to prevent the attack from taking place in the first place, particularly when the consequences of the attack are very large. Now, that lesson got driven home to the American people, and people all over the world, for that matter, by the attack on 9/11, as we saw this catastrophe. And people started snooping around and saying, why didn't somebody see that when people wanted to learn how to fly but not to take off or land and stuff like that, that there was a problem coming? We didn't connect the dots. Remember that?
Yes, very well.
What would we have done if we had connected the dots?
Would we have attacked Iraq?
No, we would have stopped the people who were trying to fly those planes into mm-hmm. our buildings from mm-hmm. doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have try to find out more about them. Why were they doing this? Where was this planned? And then you go after where it was planned, so you prevent the attack from taking place. That's, well, and I think to a very great extent, it's a no-brainer. That is, of course you're going to try to stop something that you can see coming.
But we missed that.
It gets more dicey when you say the origins of the attack are in some other country. Then what do we do? Well, we knew Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan. And so we went after him in Afghanistan. We also knew that Saddam Hussein had a long record of attacking his neighbors and unsavory behavior of all kinds. And I might say, in the inspections after he was deposed, they found his chemical and biological weapons programs were on the shelf, ready to go.
Well, pretty deep on the shelf.
And he was running terrorist training camps. So he was in this line of work. But at any rate, as far as the general doctrine is concerned, it's you run into all sorts of fuzzy areas when you go to another country. But as far as not being content just to enforce the law after an act has taken place and being more aggressive and trying to stop them from taking place in the first place, I think that's become universal all over the world.
A couple of years
particularly
ago.
Particularly in your own country.
Yes.
Don't you agree with that?
Well, who would want a 9/11 if they could see it coming? Who wouldn't want to stop those guys?
Absolutely. That's the point.
On the other hand, I wonder how you feel. A couple of years ago, Daniel Henniger with the Wall Street Journal editorial page sat down with you. He called you the father of the Bush Doctrine, essentially the Bush Doctrine on preemption. And I wonder how you're looking at that major act of so-called preemption in Iraq. I mean, given that we missed the terrorists who were inside the United States, 9/11 happened, we went after bin Laden, we missed him in Afghanistan, then we went in with both feet in Iraq. Your reputation is as a very level-headed guy. You see what that intervention in Iraq has cost the country in money and lives and maybe global reputation. How do you weigh the Iraq intervention at this point and the idea that you may be the father of that intervention conceptually?
Well, I'm not the father of it, but I think the idea of taking preventive action when you see a threat is common sense, and you just got through agreeing with me on that.
Well, now, within the United States, if you're going after guys who are learning to fly but not land.
So the question is, first of all, intelligence. How confident do you have to be about your intelligence? Now, I'm not privy to what's going on. I'm not in the loop at all in the Bush administration, so what all the debate was, I don't know. But apparently, our intelligence agencies and the agencies in other countries as well got it wrong. And this is one of the great problems you have to confront. Intelligence is difficult. And when you're trying to get intelligence about a murky group of unsavory characters, it's even more difficult. So you have to be careful.
The Iraq War has been called the greatest disaster in American foreign policy history. Some of your former colleagues, Brent Scowcroft, have been quite critical of it, even within the Republican camp. I mean, I take your point as you see it on preemption, but when you look at the facts of what's happened with Iraq, how do you judge this intervention?
It's obvious that it hasn't gone well. That is, I should say it differently. The initial attack was done brilliantly, and Saddam Hussein was displaced. And I think most people would say, yeah, that's a very good thing. But afterwards, it hasn't gone well. And there are all sorts of reasons for that, I'm sure. Some of it I think I realize just from the outside, and probably people involved see them more clearly. But I remember when looting was permitted, people were relaxed about the looting. I said to myself, boy,
Stuff happens, Donald Rumsfeld said.
That's got to be a mistake, because looting is a statement that you're not in control. So apparently we didn't get control quickly enough, and maybe we should have had more troops after the invasion than we did. I don't know that, but you can argue that. Certainly, it's very arguable that while you want to sort of decapitate the ministries of government and the armed forces and so on from the Saddam Hussein loyalists, nevertheless, the bureaucracies and the military force, the military, probably you want to keep intact and put them under new leadership because they are the way in which you administer a country. So apparently mistakes were made, and so we've had a bad scene in Iraq. Maybe it's beginning to get better, but the stakes are very high. Don't forget that.
I want to look at more at those stakes. George Shultz, a lot of our listeners want to speak with you. George Shultz's new book is Putting Our House in Order. And let's take a call from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Ronnie, you're on the air with former Secretary of State George Shultz.
Hello there, Mr. Shultz. I've long been of the opinion that it would be more appropriate for Iraqi parents to sacrifice Iraqi sons and daughters for the sake of Iraqi freedom rather than American sons and daughters for Iraqi freedom. You just said during this show that it hasn't gone well since it began, this notion of preemptive action. And it seems naive of us that we are to assume that Iraqis will embrace Jeffersonian democracy and Republican government in a single generation when they have been theocrats for the past few thousand years. With that said, I've heard it postulated that Ronald Reagan, because he was a shrewd politician, either allowed or perhaps even proactively played a role in setting up Saddam Hussein, who was a thug, who was not very religious, although he made himself appear to be whenever it was appropriate, allowed him to take control of that region, what he did have control of, because he could do a much better job of it than we seem to be doing now. In other words, the people that we are having such a hard time with controlling and persuading and dissuading right now are the very people that we needed Saddam Hussein for.
Ronnie, let us pick it up with Secretary Shultz. George Shultz, how about it? Saddam Hussein may have been a thug, but was he effective in terms of real politic for American policy? Was he a product of your foreign policy in the Middle East?
No, he was not our product, and he was a horrible man. And the people of Iraq, particularly the Shiites, the Kurds, he gassed them. We were one of the few countries that got up and criticized him heavily for that. I did personally.
But he also had American support for a time, didn't
he?
He
was a terrible guy. Now, there was an Iraq-Iran war going on.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want Iran to win that war. We wanted to get it stopped. And eventually, we did. Although we had no decent relations with either one. We did have diplomatic relations with Iraq, but not with Iran. And so we did things that helped. And as the Cold War was coming to an end, we were able to do it in conjunction with the Soviet Union and get that awful war to stop. Mm. Millions of people were killed in that war. So it was a humanitarian effort on our part to bring that about. But let me go back to the statements made by the man from Virginia.
Yes.
He infers that the idea of preemption, preventive action, has been discredited. I certainly don't think so. No doubt it's the reason why we haven't had further attacks on American soil, because we have found out about them before they occurred and stopped them from happening. Or you take London. We're very aware of the bombings in London, right?
Yes.
But it's also clear, at least from what I read of the what has come out of that, that the British did manage to stop a fairly large number of attacks that were being planned before they occurred.
But can you draw a line between that and the Iraq invasion? I mean, that's the major act of preemption here, and I think there's a lot of skepticism about how important that particular and very costly act has been in the kind of disruption of terror that you describe. People see Iraq also as a training ground and recruiting ground for terror. The Iran, who you described as the U.S. wanting and needing to stop, seems to have been vastly empowered during the time of this war. And even in Afghanistan, we just saw an assassination attempt on Karzai over the weekend. It hardly looks like a model of stability. And you know what's up in Pakistan. It doesn't look like a comforting picture by my lights, but what about yours?
Well, it's a tough world out there and has been for some time and no doubt will continue to be. It's a very difficult situation to cope with. On the whole, I think we've been doing a reasonable job of it, but it's very hard going.
Do you think Bush policy has, in effect, empowered Iran, the country you were concerned about checking when you were Secretary of State? It seems Tehran seems to be, in many ways, in the catbird seat now.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think they're inherently a very weak country, have played their cards well. And, of course, there is the threat of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. And I've been working with some other people, Bill Perry, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, and a whole bunch of other people, to turn around our attitude toward nuclear weapons. But if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, then, well, already countries in the Middle East who are loaded with oil and gas are saying we have to have nuclear power plants. Why do they want a nuclear power plant? Because they want to get the ingredients for a nuclear weapon. So this kind of proliferation getting out of control has got to be very worrisome, and Iraq needs to be curbed.
Do you see, I mean, your reputation is as a very level-headed guy. Do you see something that could look like a victory anywhere on the horizon in Iraq after these years and expenditures of blood and money?
Yes, I can imagine one, but I'm not close to the situation, so I wouldn't hazard a prediction, but I can imagine that what we're doing now is creating more and more areas of stability. And when you have an area of stability, you know, economics is quicker than politics. Market forces rush in. People want to have stores to buy things and so forth. And some more normal life begins to return. People like that. And they look to the leaders of the sects or clans or whatever in that area to help preserve it. And if you build more and more of these spots around, you can get a greater stability in Iraq, sort of from the bottom up. And as our forces are able to root out the al-Qaeda forces in Iraq and defeat them, which seems to be taking place, that's a huge victory in the broader war against the use of terror by Islamic extremists. Mm. So there's a lot going on there. And if Iraq should manage to become a reasonably representative government with undoubtedly a lot of decentralization.
George Shultz, please hold the thought. I'm sorry to interrupt. You have to take a short break. Secretary of State George Shultz, this is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former Secretary of State George Shultz about the big challenges facing the United States today. He was Secretary of Labor and Secretary of Treasury under Richard Nixon, famously from 1982 to 89, Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. Introduced Condoleezza Rice, at least that's what the record says, to George W. Bush in 1998 when George Bush was governor of Texas. He's out with a new book now called Putting Our House in Order, A Guide to Social Security and Healthcare Reform. But he's got a big view on a lot of fronts. Let's take a call from Boston. Paul, you're on the air with George Shultz.
Let me interrupt you for a second.
Oh, yes. One moment, Paul. Yes, Mr. Shultz.
You left out a couple of items in my biography which are relevant to the topic of the book.
It's such a long one, but we'll take them. It's a deep bio.
Well, I was director of the Office of Management and Budget.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got to be concerned about budgets. And I did pitch in and help both the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration on particular things. So while I'm a loyal Republican, I've learned how to work across the aisle.
Duly noted. And a background in economics that goes all the way back to a PhD from MIT, and then you were dean at the University of Chicago Business School for a time. So it is a rich and varied bio, one of the richest, I would say. Paul, you're on the line with George Shultz and everything he represents. What do you say?
Great show, Tom. Thank you. Let's not also forget, you know, part of his bio is, you know, he was the chairman of the pro-war committee for the liberation of Iraq. And as just before the war, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post under the headline, "Act Now, the Danger is Immediate." And a snippet in that article, "A strong foundation exists for immediate military action against Hussein and for a multilateral effort to rebuild Iraq after he's gone." At that time, Mr. Shultz was a heavyweight in the Bechtel Group of San Francisco. And soon after the war, what do you know? The Bechtel Group gets a $680 million reconstruction contract.
The Bechtel Group, the huge global construction firm in engineering, yeah.
Right. And Mr. Shultz was a president, and he was also a board member and senior counselor of the Bechtel Group. And they get the contract, and he was beating the drums for the war in Iraq. So how does Mr. Shultz reconcile his conflict of interest?
George Shultz?
Well, I find the insinuation repulsive. There was no connection whatever. I might say that at the time I was totally out of the management of Bechtel. I was still a director, but I was not involved in the management. But the argument for going into Iraq was the focus of my attention, and I think given the evidence we had, the conviction that was very widespread that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, had chemical and biological weapons, whatever else he may have been trying to get, according to the intelligence people, was compelling, not only in our country but elsewhere. And he was a known, very bad actor. So that's the idea of preventing him from making use of those weapons against us. That's the whole justification.
Can you understand now, the unease? I mean, Americans knew, of course, of Vice President Cheney's old relationship with Halliburton, and so I understand. You find it a repulsive insinuation, and yet you know politics well, and you know public perception, how it matters. You've seen what's happened with the popularity of this war. You must be sensitive to the unease that people may feel with some of these associations when things go so badly.
Well, when things go well, wasn't it President Kennedy who said, defeat is an orphan, yeah. Success has many fathers. When we were succeeding, everybody was for it. When we're having difficulty, it's harder to sell. And so some things have happened that have been surprising to the intelligence. They didn't find what they thought they were going to find, which was the primary justification. So that's set you back. It reminds you that when you take these kinds of actions, you have to really be sure about your intelligence. It's hard to do. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that the whole thing after the fall of Saddam Hussein could have been handled better. And maybe we're beginning to do that now. We'll see.
What do you make of Brent Scowcroft's, he's been muted but not silent on the whole Iraq war push. There seems to be a kind of fundamental critique of the White House posture, maybe of Condoleezza Rice and their approach to, you know, laying out this war and then going at it. Is there a leftover philosophical debate going on in this Republican White House from your time in office that you recognize in the critique of Brent Scowcroft?
Well, Brent, of course, was part of the first Bush administration, and they had their war with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the object of which was to expel him from Kuwait. And they did that successfully. Then they chose to stop. And they chose to stop largely because they didn't want to get involved in trying to manage Iraq. And that looks like a pretty wise decision at this point, although the situation has become different, without a doubt. And now we have a problem of seeing if we can't make something better out of it.
He was national security.
I might say that the Reagan doctrine that was developed by President Reagan, and which I supported and took part in, was along the lines of, we would support people who are ready to fight for freedom in their country and give them moral support, provide them with material support on occasion. We were very careful in using our armed forces. The biggest catastrophe in the Reagan administration, in my opinion, our most awful moment, was when we learned about the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. Mm. Those Marines were there on a peacekeeping mission. It was not a warfighting mission. But that was very bad news. Other than that, we used our armed forces once on a raid in Libya and once to bring Americans back from a murderous regime in Grenada. We were in and out. So the Reagan doctrine was strong, have strength, but we were very careful in the use of our armed forces.
Ronald Reagan had American troops out of Beirut within days or weeks, as I recall, of that attack in 1982. Do you think Ronald Reagan would have countenanced putting 150,000, or you name the number, American troops into Iraq for, what is it, 5+ years now?
Actually, when the Marine barracks were bombed, I think it was 1983, we had a Marine contingent go there and replace those Marines. And they stayed for 3 or 4 months. So we didn't just pull out. But then we saw and concluded that there was very little mission for them there under all the circumstances, and so they were withdrawn. But we didn't just react by pulling up stakes and leaving.
But it's a far cry from a major American military intervention, and I wonder about how you read Ronald Reagan's instincts in that circumstance versus George W. Bush's and maybe Condoleezza Rice's a couple of decades later.
Well, it's hard to say. Situations differ. As one of your questioners said, I did write an article before the invasion of Iraq supporting it, and I wouldn't change the article now, given what we knew at the time. If we had known that there were no weapons of mass destruction there, then I think my case would have been different.
Let's go to Millington, Maryland, and a call from Paul. Hi, Paul. You're on the air with George Shultz.
How are you today?
Very well.
I'm changing subject a little bit. I just want to ask a quick question. I have a mutual friend, or actually he's deceased now, Dr. Arthur Fleming, who was also in the Eisenhower administration. Mm-hmm. And we used to go to lunch regularly. And he had told me that at one time they were to the point of actually announcing a national health insurance plan. And I wondered if Mr. Shultz could comment on whatever happened with that.
do you have some sense of what happened with that, Paul?
Well, no. I mean, the only thing I understand is it got shot down by some others after they had already developed a speech to announce it and things like that.
Let's see. George Shultz, Paul recalls via Arthur Fleming that there was a full-fledged national health care plan up on the rails and ready to go in the Eisenhower administration. You were an economic advisor. What happened to that? What's the history?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with that. I know that President Nixon had a plan. People have worked on this over the years for obvious reasons. It's an important issue. Let me point out something about the health care area that we bring it out in our book and which people don't seem to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
The health care system as such is not the reason why we have greater length of life and greater health now than, say, 25 or 30 years ago. That is attributable to the fact that we have sponsored a great deal of basic research into how the human body works. And the basic research has led to pharmaceuticals of all kinds that help avoid or deal with diseases of one sort or another. And out of the basic research has come devices like an MRI that allows a physician to examine your insides without cutting you open, and so on and so on and so on. Polio vaccine. So it's this marvelous line of research that's been so productive. And for this reason, I'm very upset about the fact that the budget for the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, which has sponsored, been a big sponsor of the basic research, has been sort of straight-lined, not increased much in recent years. And that's been a big setback for this research. So one of the things in our book that we push on pretty hard is let's examine that, and it's very much in our interest to fund that basic research fully.
But does that go back in some way to the very sort of Milton Friedman impulse you spoke of earlier, George Shultz, and maybe the lower taxes, which you celebrated as a legacy of the Reagan era? Are those not related to the cutbacks that you are upset with, for example, in basic research? The government doesn't have the resources.
No, I don't think so. I think the dollars involved in that are small by standards of the federal budget. It's not, can't be attributable on that. Here is a measure of why I think we can get a lot out of reforming the healthcare system. And after all, I wrote this book along with my colleague John Chauvin because we were upset with what is going on and we want to get it changed for the better. So you ask yourself, what is there evidence that the way the healthcare system works right now wastes money and misallocates resources? So we've looked into that. And the answer is a very strong yes. The New York Times did a very good job of studying the way Medicaid worked in New York. And the results of their study are appalling. They identified all kinds of examples of waste and inefficiency in the system. Then there's a wonderful group of doctors at Dartmouth that have looked at many aspects of how Medicare works. And they compare people with exactly the same age, health status, and so forth, living in different cities. And a lot more is spent in some cities than on others with no impact on health. So you say something's wrong with this picture. And then the RAND Corporation has made some very interesting, careful studies of it. And so you say to yourself, there is a great deal of room for improvement. You can, if you can get rid of those wasteful practices, then you'll be able to spend the money more effectively, and we can get out of this mess that we're in.
I want to get another call or two, if I may, from Orlando, Florida. We have Anthony on the line. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi. A number of times now in the course of your conversation, Mr. Shultz has said that the intelligence was wrong, the intelligence concerning weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Mm. And that's just not true. We know from a variety of people now, from journalists like Naomi Klein and Tom Ricks and Bob Woodward, to people inside of the administration like George Tenet, that the people in the CIA who were developing the intelligence were saying, it says this, and it says that we can't come into any kind of firm conclusion about what Saddam Hussein has. And in some cases, the conclusions that they were drawing were that he doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. People around George Bush, Mr. Rumsfeld, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Wolfowitz, and others were saying, no, 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 no. We want to see the intelligence the way we want to see the intelligence. It's this, that's not wrong. That's a cooking of the available information to make an argument that they already wanted to make. People like Mr. Shultz have to stop saying that the intelligence was wrong. Thank you.
Anthony, our time runs down. George Shultz, what about it? You know the allegations of cooked intelligence, and I wonder if you see that as a misuse, a kind of hijacking of your preemption impulse if it's taken off in a direction the intelligence doesn't support.
Well, comments like the ones just made are hijacking the truth, because All sorts of investigations have been done on exactly that point, and they all come to the conclusion that there was no cooking of intelligence. And as a matter of fact, the questioner, or he didn't ask a question, he just made a statement, quoted Bob Woodward, but Bob Woodward in his book quotes the president pushing George Tenet about the existence of the weapons of mass destruction. In other words, he was raising questions. And George Tenet, the director of the CIA, then said, Mr. President, it's a slam dunk.
Well,
so
yes.
So that's what the intelligence people were saying.
The phrase is there, though we've heard Tenet dance a couple ways on that, and the charge of stovepiping around intelligence at the same time. It's more than we're going to get our hands entirely around here. You say that there's a contradiction in this country between the evidence of success and the current atmosphere of unease, and it calls for a change in mindset. Do you see a change in mindset coming in this country, Mr. Schultz?
Well, we're trying to get a change in mindset toward the dilemmas of the Social Security and healthcare system. And the change we want to get is stop moaning and groaning about it and do something about it.
We're out of time
with
that.
And there are all kinds of things you can do, so let's get busy and act.
We hear it. George Schultz, thanks very much for being with us. This is On Point.